are listening to the Doug Hagmann Radio Show, weekdays 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And now the man behind the mic, a private investigator with over 30 years under his belt, Doug Hagmann.
Good morning, everyone. It's 6 a.m. on the West Coast of America, 9 a.m. here in the East. Welcome to Hagmann. It's the Doug Hagmann Investigative Hour for today. It is Tuesday, June 5th, 2018. Thanks for joining me this morning. Going to take an in-depth look at what's going on. Well, a lot of headlines, a lot of information, of course, a leak over the weekend about the pardon issue. Not going to get into that too much, except to say the mainstream media is just having a meltdown over the potential pardoning of the president pardoning himself. And that's not the story. That's not the story. It's the story is the leak. Where did this come from? It looks like it came from within the Mueller. It looks like an intentional leak by Mueller. All right. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, over the weekend, there was some issue about, well, is it constitutional for the president to pardon himself? And there was some documentation that was released to the media, and the media went just into a meltdown mode over this. And okay, well, what's this all about? Well, can the president pardon himself, and why should he, and would he? And of course, the media, along with the left, they just went apoplectic about this, because, well, wait a minute, that would just destroy our constitutional republic. Well, again, the misdirection by the media is the story. It's not the content of what was leaked. It's the leak. And why did they leak this? When you just take a step back and everyone take a breath, okay? Again, if you don't think this is a big idea, it's probably not a big deal. That is, if you don't think this is a big deal, it's probably not outside of the circles of Washington, which is probably why, you know, it's just in passing. Or it's not a big deal outside of the leftist communes, the mental communes by the left. But the what it was some I'll classify it as interdepartmental communication. Now, that's not really, I'm sure, how they would classify it, but some legal opinions on, well, can the president pardon himself or herself? That was the communications themselves were leaked out. And that, to me, that's the story. Who leaked them and why? And when you take a step back, it's because, in my view, that the Mueller hit squad, the Mueller political assassination team, is desperate. They're losing. So they've got to play, well, by no rules. So Mueller, somebody within the Mueller camp, released this communication. Yeah, I guess the president, you know, legally could pardon himself. And then of course, you see the talking heads just exploding. Morning Joe saying, yeah, you might get one, maybe two Supreme Court justices to agree with you on that, but your political career in the United States, basically, as we know it, is over. Okay, well, again, misdirection. Everyone pointing, everyone looking at the what supposedly the leak was about, the content. If you look at the blowback from the leak, it could not have been timed better by the Mueller team. And I think that the Mueller team is showing its weakness, showing that they are truly black hats everywhere, that they're an arm of the deep state. So I think that's what we should be focused upon. We should be looking at. It's not the contents of the leak. It's not whether the president can pardon himself. That's still a hypothetical. I mean, beyond anything. And if you remember, this came up back in the Clinton presidency. And it came up in the Nixon administration. It's interesting to go back in history and look. It did not cause the media, rampant media speculation that it's causing today. So when you compare the media apparatus during the Nixon administration, You have a modicum of fairness or a balance, shall we say. at that time. You had the three basic networks, and you had four perhaps, and then of course the print media of various stripes all across the United States. There was a level of fairness there. There was a level of there was no hair on fire. Hey, you know, this is going to end the republic. Now today you've got this one leak over the weekend, the one leak, and then the response to this leak, where you've got the majority of the people on cable television saying that our country is imperiled by the actions of Donald Trump, the hypothetical actions. But it all stems from what? It stems from a leak to the media about a hypothetical situation. That's what we're looking at. Look at not the content, but the reaction to the content. And look at how that all came about. I like to ask why. I like to look at things and say, well, why now, for example? Why at this moment would a hypothetical about a presidential pardon of a president, why would that come out right now? Why not wait 6 months or whenever supposedly it might be more relevant? Because Mueller has nothing, and Mueller is in damage control. Think of it as attempting to ensure or assure additional job security and get the public, the anti-Trump public, on the side of the special counsel. That's what the issue is here. So that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with, clearly, an antagonistic press, a media that has combined forces, its forces, to operate as an extension of the Mueller investigation, the Mueller special counsel investigation, in search of a crime. Remember, the Mueller investigation was established. They were looking at Donald Trump and searching for a crime. It would be much like your local police coming to your house and looking at your life in search of a crime. Who called them? What are they doing there? That's what we're dealing with today. You know, I could give you analogy after analogy after analogy, but I think you get it. I think everyone gets it. Anyone with a working, brain gets it. We're seeing the ultimate battle between the deep state, the shadow government, and the representative republic members therein. And I just marvel at this. I sit back and I look at how this all started. And yesterday, I spent the entire program giving you some deep background, I think deep background, to show you that this is not about Donald Trump, really. Donald Trump the man. This is about Donald Trump, everything he represents. This is about taking out Donald Trump because Donald Trump represents the will of the deplorables, the American people, you and I, who are so sick and tired of the Clintons and the Obamas and the royalty and the purple. You know what I'm talking about. We're tired of it. We're tired of the two-tier justice system. We're just sick and tired of being treated like serfs in the fiefdom of the deep state globalists. It's a deeper issue. Now, how was this all set up? Because yesterday and this weekend, looking at this leak, and I didn't mention this yesterday because I wanted it to percolate a little bit. I wanted to see where this was going. And I see where it's going. And I see what is being caused by this particular leak. So, okay, if we did kind of a deep dive into the background yesterday. Why don't we do right now a kind of a timeline, if you will. And I do these often, but it's important because it gives us a sense of the criminal activity. It's I remember taking courses, one course in particular, a forensic blood spatter analysis course, and spending just countless hours, you know, with looking at actually one crime scene and analyzing this crime scene and over and over and over again. And then others would look at it, and it was, you know, it was set up by the professor, and it was done. It was a time tested crime scene, I guess. It was used numerous times, and the reason I bring this up is because that was the standard. There was a standard that was set where maybe there were, I don't know, 50 points of specific interest or relevance that had to be noted and discovered and written down in order to understand, recreate what happened at that particular scene. So that's what I kind of want to do here, and I'm trying to do here, is we're taking a look really at the same crime scene from different perspectives and making sure we have all of the relevant points noted. And not only that, all of the people involved, whether they're deep state operatives, leaders like the Brennans and like Obama and like Clinton, okay, we know what they're doing, but what about the people who are helping them? And what about the timeline? As I said yesterday, this goes back, it goes back far. And this one issue alone, what is happening, what is happening right now with the special counsel, with Mueller, what is happening with the OIG, what is happening with Congress, both on the House and Senate side, what the media is doing, all of these players now are coming to the surface, and we are looking at the participants in a crime. The crime is to overthrow our country. It's happening in real time, but it didn't ignite. It didn't happen all of a sudden. It was set up. It was set up to this point. This, the insurance policy, or the insurance that the agenda, the deep state shadow government agenda, would continue, it really, in a sense, had no, they really had no plan B, because they were so sure of plan A. Plan A, of course, is Hillary Clinton getting in. Plan B did not exist until closer to election day. And plan B is assailing Trump and getting President Donald Trump out of office. That's plan B. And different factions or subsets of plan B exist. And we see it happening today. Plan B is still going on. The criminals, the deep state elements, are still pushing plan B. And oh, by the way, we're all involved in plan B. Because we're all being exposed to the media's biases, but criminal, in my view, criminal activity against all of us. Plan B is the Obama holdovers, the deep state assets, the senior executive staff, deep state operatives in government and in non-governmental organizations working to overthrow our country from within. That's plan B. When I looked at the timeline, and six different versions of timelines. Timeline done by Cheryl Atkinson. Timeline done, numerous timelines. All just done by different people for different purposes. And when you overlay all of the timelines, obviously there are some many, many dates that are identical. So just imagine, just remember transparencies. Remember those when you're in school. I don't even know if they still have those or not, but imagine timelines written on or typed on transparencies. Same font, same everything. And each transparency represents a different timeline, and you overlay them. And, of course, you have matches, certain matches with the dates and such. But now maybe that's a bad analogy, because if you think of a timeline, you could add more and subtract more. But regardless, there are certain dates that are more important than others. And there's one aspect of this I want to get into right now. I also want to point to and I'm going to put this in the program description notes. I promise I will. You know, we have the flagship show has Captain Roy D on, and he's a poster at Reddit. Hey, Captain Roy. There was a post made, I believe it was yesterday, at Reddit. And I'll put the link, like I said, into the program description box. I want to call your attention to it, and I would suggest click on the link and read it. The subject of discussion is Two Spies and Two Assets Confirmed Obamagate/Spygate. And this is what I've been talking about. And when you compare notes with excellent citizen reporters, investigative journalists, investigators like Captain Roy D., who do a lot of work, thankless work, but basically do the work that the media doesn't or won't, you find out very interesting tidbits. And he writes that this is more than spy versus spy, or even white hat versus black hat. It's basically good versus evil, and that's what we were talking about yesterday. The scorecard can chalk up two confirmed official spies and two planted intelligence assets in the Trump world, of course. Now, remember, I have been speaking about the number of spies implanted in the Donald Trump presidential campaign. My sources tell me three. I was speaking with Owen Schroyer, War Room, and Alex Jones and his staff, and you're looking at, according to their numbers, upwards of six all across the non-Hillary camps. And I do believe that number to be correct, upwards of six. When you're looking at the non-Hillary people and you're looking at the totality, whether it's Cruz, remember all of the people back then, the candidates. But I do believe that there was an insinuation of black hat assets into the various campaigns. But writes Captain Roy D., incredibly, back in January 2014, at the first known public meeting between President Donald Trump, at that time, Mr. Trump, and General Flynn, Stefan Halper was also in attendance. So just put a full stop right there. When you are talking about Stefan Halper being a CIA asset, and look, I have been an asset for the Department of Justice and for the FBI. I've been used in that capacity, both an informational asset and an operational asset. And this is going back a number of years ago, back when I believe the Department of Justice at least had a better track record than the FBI, and other agencies had a better track record. And this is long before, this is before 9/11. Okay, so and I'm not excusing what I've done or explaining what I've done. It's just a matter of fact. So I kind of know the environment. When you are an asset for a specific agency, I have experience in that. All right, so I know what I'm talking about to some extent. Now, obviously, I don't know everything, and I don't claim to know everything, but I know my experience, and I know what I had to go through, and I know how I was handled and treated, and what forms I had to sign, and how I was positioned and such. So from that perspective, writes Captain Roy D. at Reddit, you can read this. Again, the link will be in the program description. It was back in 2014, January, when Stefan Halper reared his head into this mix. There was an annual gathering of past intelligence assets that was held in London. The helper sent a report back to John Brennan about Flynn seemingly being very cozy with a Russian, actually an FSB woman, as well as the meeting between Donald Trump and Michael Flynn. And Captain Roy D. mentions as well Nader, N-A-D-E-R. And we need to be looking at George Nader, this transition spy, shadowy international figure that has recently been connected to the United Arab Emirates Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, or Zayed. And don't discount Nader. Look at Nader as an intelligence asset, transition spy, if you will, according to Captain Roy D. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it would be good. He's got a couple or numerous links in that, in his piece. But do yourself a favor and look at that, okay? And thank you, Captain Roy D., for this. But if we want to get in, again, if we want to continue in the meat of this, I want to go back and look at how this was created. We know it's easy to say that the Department of Justice, the FBI, the intelligence community was weaponized by Obama. It's easy to say that and then move on to something else. But what about taking a look, going back to the crime scene that for example, I studied for all that time and I referenced in others' study, and you've got to make sure you've got all 50 or however many points of relevance there are. You've identified it all so you understand what really happened. Because if you have 49, you really don't know the entire story. And I found that out in my classroom work. You know, that's why they have classes. That's to teach. And so it's important that we have the entire picture. But just as Captain Roy D. mentioned Halper's arrival in the scene back in 2014, this well long before President Donald Trump announced his run for presidency. And think about that. Just stop there and think a second. What does that tell you about the power of the intelligence community itself? If you, for example, you're not going to find an intelligence asset in my orbit or arena. Why? Because you just won't. Who am I? You know, same with you, perhaps, listening to this. Now, excepting, of course, those who are transcribing this program who are in the intelligence community. Yeah, you know who you are. But what I'm saying to you is that normally doesn't happen. So that in and of itself should tell us volumes that there was some international spy and domestic spy overlap into the world of Donald Trump back in 2014. Why would that even happen? It was specifically General Michael Flynn, Lieutenant General Michael. Which I can understand that. Given his world that he operated, in which he operated. But then you've got this dragging Donald Trump into it. But let's go back to 2016. Let's go back to, let's move ahead from 2014, go to 2016. It was on March 9th of 2016 when NSA, the head of NSA, Admiral Mike Rogers, became aware of the FBI's private sector contractors. Remember, we talk about Fusion GPS. We talk about government contractors with access to specific databases. Now, you might be wondering why I picked March 9th, 2016, and why this is important. And I want to just let you know that, for example, as a private investigator, licensed private investigator, commissioned officer of the court, basically myself, I have access to databases. I am given access to fee-based databases that the general public does not. And with that comes responsibility. It comes with oversight. I've got someone assigned to me when I access that database, I've got someone assigned to me who will look at my inquiries, my actually use of the database, and compare it to cases I'm working on. For example, if I run or if I ask for the owner of a license plate number, if I ask for the owner of a license plate number on a on somebody in Utah, for example, and I'm working a case in New York, the question becomes, what's that about? Why are you accessing that? Why are you asking about somebody in Utah if you're working a case in New York? Now, the answer could be, well, because this particular vehicle was seen at the New York residence, or, hey, gee, you got me. I just saw a pretty girl with a Utah license number or Utah license plate, and I just wanted to find out who she was. That's a bad use, obviously, and restricted use of the database. Disallowed use. And that, quicker than anything, would get me sanctioned. I would no longer have access to that database. Do you see what I'm saying now? So there has to be a legitimate reason for access of records for a database that I'm using. And this goes back to Rebecca Schaefer. If you want to know, for example, from the PI standpoint or the private investigator standpoint, remember Rebecca Schaefer. She was that young actress on My Sister Sam. There was a guy who just liked Rebecca Schaefer, apparently stalked her, and gave a PI at that time, back in the late 80s, a couple of $100 to get her home address from her, or just get her home address. I believe it was via license number or something to that effect. And as a result, this PI for $200 gave this guy the information where she lived, and he went up and knocked on her door. She answered the door, and he shot her in the face. And she passed away. And of course, since that time, and as a consequence to that and other misuses, databases have been off limits and audited and are use audited, which is I have no problem with whatsoever. But having said that, let's look at how this applies to the government use of non-governmental contractors. In other words, private contractors, for example, like myself, I could be a private contractor for the government, accessing their databases. That's what happened back on March 9th, 2016. Admiral Mike Rogers became aware that the FBI's had private contractors and they were accessing these databases. Private contractors like Fusion GPS. There were others as well. Well, on April 18th, a month later, 2016, Rogers shut down private access by private contractors to the FBI's database. The information flow was shut off. Did you know? That was on April 18th, 2016. Mike Rogers says, nope, no more. Nope, Fusion GPS, nope, you're not going to have access to the FBI databases. Shut down. Period. End of story. Well, guess what? April 18th, that very same day. That was the day that the DNC claimed that their servers were hacked. Think about that for a second. Are you seeing where I'm going with this? Now, when you start getting into this timeline and start getting into this, note that this would also apply or pull into the mix Seth Rich, the Awan brothers to some extent. But, and we can go down a number of rabbit trails from here. But I urge you to look now just at the infrastructure of the timeline here, rather than going down these specific rabbit trails. Just look at the timeline itself. So you had in March, Admiral Mike Rogers saying, hey, wait a minute. We have FBI private contractors working for the FBI accessing our databases and getting some and making these. They can see what inquiries they make, for example. Just as the databases I utilize in my capacity as a licensed investigator, the database, the people assigned to me can see what inquiries I'm making. And all of a sudden, if I'm starting to make all sorts of inquiries that don't apply to my field of investigation, or if all of a sudden I go from two or three inquiries per day to 30, there are some questions that will be asked. In the old days, I just kind of want to mention this, in the old days, and by when I say in the old days, the good old days, shall we say, trip down memory lane, as a PI, for example, I'll take you back into the 1980s, for example. I used to be able to call up a friend at the police department and say, hey, I need a plate run for me. Would you do it? Yeah, you buy me a beer? Yeah, sure, okay. Here it is. Or, hey, I need an NCIC check run on so-and-so. Yeah, okay, no problem. Well, obviously, with the growth of technology, that whole thing has been shut down. The police today don't dare do that. Everything is monitored. That beer is a costly beer, let me tell you. Or for example, because private investigators, in my case, but think too, I mean, this would be the same as opposition research individual or groups or entities. They're commerce, they're commodities, it's information. So I just want to drive this point home so you understand the process, because you're not going to hear this on the evening news. You're not going to see this or hear this with Morning Joe or anything. Or even some of the people that have been in the business, you're not going to hear this. Not that it's any deep, dark secret, but people don't spend the time to explain this to people because they should, because it's important. But back in the 1980s, you develop contacts because information was the commodity. Information was what we dealt in. Well, you develop a friend at the bank, at banks, for example, or at the credit bureau. Hey, can you run a credit header check for me? You know, or a friend at the bank. Hey, can you give me some information about John Smith? How much does he have in the bank? Or, you know, does he have any loans with you? All of that off the books record sharing or information sharing. And that was constant. So at the end of the day, if I was looking at John Smith, I mentioned that name, obviously, just as an example, I might make four or five phone calls and I could find out what kind of car he owned, how much he has left to pay on it, how much he paid for it, how much he's got in his bank, how many times his bank account's been overdrawn, and so on. You get the idea, right? Well, from that, you can get a picture of the vulnerabilities of John Smith or whoever you're looking at if the information is misused. And that's what we're talking about here. Specifically, this is what we're talking about. In every inquiry today, there are forensic fingerprints on every inquiry, which is why when the information flow, and this is, if you take nothing else from this show today, understand this, when Mike Rogers, who I believe is a white hat, all right, and protective of President Donald Trump based on something I'm going to tell you here in a second and remind you of it in a second, and you know where I'm going with this, but every inquiry leaves a digital fingerprint today. So in other words, if I make an inquiry with my databases, they know where the inquiry came from, they know that I made it, and the ostensible reason I gave for making the inquiry. However, that's subject to audit. So when Admiral Mike Rogers cut off the information flow of non-FBI or non-governmental actors or organizations such as Fusion GPS, when he cut off access to the FBI databases, they had to go to their plan B. Well, okay, just imagine, go back to what I said. What happens if the police officer that I was using back in the 1980s, and we'll take it back then, what happens if he's on vacation or retires? You got to get a different source. You got to go a different way. This is exactly what happened. Or the individual at the bank giving me the bank balance information. What happens if that person is terminated or retires or goes on vacation. You got to have somebody else there. All right. Well, of course, this is 2016, 2014, 15, 16. This is now the 21st century. So things are a little bit different. But the idea is the same. So now what happens? Admiral Mike Rogers cuts off that information for Fusion GPS and other contractors like Fusion GPS. So the spies, the people attempting, for example, to create the research information documents against Donald Trump, and those people, they've got to have another source. They've got to go to Plan B, because no one left. For example, when their police friend at the police department went on vacation, he did not say, "Hey, Bubba, take care of my buddy over here," when he calls. And he didn't tell me. So they got to go to a different plan. And isn't it coincidental or not that that's the day when the information was cut off, the access was cut off? That was the day that the DNC said, "Hey, you know what? Our servers were hacked by the Russians." But you know, the DNC famously refused to allow the FBI to examine their servers, which has always been a bit odd. But the DNC, through CrowdStrike, said, "Well, we have proof of Russian hacking." Okay. No, not so much. You've got now. See, this is tied. The claims of Russian hacking of the DNC servers is tied to NSA Director Rogers' discovery of outside contractors. Period. End of story. Again, the generalized story is that the DNC was hacked back in April of 2016. That's not true. And the DNC, there's a lawsuit filed. Russia's cyber attack on the DNC supposedly began only weeks after President Donald Trump announced his candidacy for president back in June of 2015. The Intelligence Committee report concluded that in July 2015, Russian intelligence gained access to the Democratic National Committee networks and maintained that access until at least June of 2016. In April of 2016, another set of Russian intelligence agents successfully hacked into the DNC. April 18th, 2016, remember the date, April 18th, 2016, Russia launched a second phase of its cyber attacks on DNC servers located in Virginia, Washington, D.C. This attack was executed by Russian intelligence agents, GRU agents. This is according to the story. They stole thousands of DNC documents and emails and such. And this is where Guccifer 2.0 and Fuzzy Bear and Wuzzy Bear and all those, you know, supposed individuals or Cozy Bear, Fancy Bear, based on forensic analysis. These are the adversaries using the code names Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. Made the breaches, supposedly. This is where all that comes in. But that, again, we're going down too far. I'm giving you an overview here. So what am I telling you? Well, it's very simply this. When Mike Rogers cut off the access to the databases, the adversaries against Donald Trump went to Plan B. And that's where we find people such as Papadopoulos and others come into the picture. You have human assets now. All right, so let me take you back. On or just after March 9th, 2016, NSA Director Mike Rogers became aware of improper access to raw FISA data. This is the data I'm talking about, the database information, raw FISA data. As a matter of fact, it was on March 9th, Department of Justice oversight personnel conducting a minimization review at the FBI learned that the FBI had disclosed raw FISA information, including but not limited to Section 702 acquired information. Okay, Section 702, FISA data, FISA information. This is all top secret stuff. But FISA access was being granted to private contractors. Think Fusion GPS. So, wait a minute. What are you telling me? People like me could get into this database? Yep. And do what? Weaponize the information. That's about it. But Mike Rogers put a stop to it. And by the way, the FISA access was very broad. The apparent purpose for the FBI's granting such access was to receive analytical assistance from, well, Fusion GPS. Let's just say that, all right, as an example. I'm not saying, but I'm saying, all right? Just using that as an example. Nonetheless, the contractors, like Fusion GPS, they had access to raw FISA information that went well beyond what was necessary to respond to this so-called analytical assistance. So in other words, what I told you before, like me, well, I'm working a case in New York, and I need this information. I need information about, oh, I don't know, Hillary Clinton. Or I'm working a case in Idaho. Man, I don't know, I need information about Hillary Clinton. Or Huma Abedin, or you know, whatever. Turn the tables a little bit. You see where I'm going with this. So, again, April 18th, Director Rogers shut down the contractor access to the FISA data. Well, then the DNC, oh, no, I've been hacked. We've been hacked. Because the FBI discontinued access to raw FISA information as of April 18th, 2016. It was discovered March 9th, discontinued April 18th. Okay, but you should know that access had been going on since at least, well, for quite a while, for a number of years. The NSA examined all queries using identifiers for U.S. persons targeted from November 1st, 2015 to May 1st, 2016. And they found abuses of the information, the database, the use of databases. So, Admiral Rogers' discovery and subsequent discontinuation of private contractors created a problem for the FBI. Access to the NSA database was not shut down, or at least, you know, impeded. Too bad, so sad. So, what happens? Think Fusion GPS. Think Nellie Orr, the wife of Bruce Orr, going to work for Fusion GPS. Can't get it, you know, can't get the information by normal database inquiry or queries. All right. Well, I got an idea. Hey, Nellie, would you mind working for Fusion GPS and, look, we'll get you the information. We'll create a different flow of information. Again, think back to my example where I was, you know, had contacts within like banks and in other places where I can get information without going through a database. I can get it directly from the people at the bank, or I can get it directly from, I don't know, my contact or my source at the police department. I hope this kind of structures or gives you an idea of what happened. Kind of explains it with, you know, in a simple fashion. So instead of these contractors, for example, like Fusion GPS, getting it via database, they went to their plan B because Mike Rogers came in and says, this doesn't fly. This doesn't work. So we're going to shut this access down. So the opposition, the people attempting to take down Donald Trump and the people who are working against our republic, well, what they did was they developed human intelligence sources, and they inserted these human intelligence sources where the information existed. That was plan B, their plan B. That's kind of what hopefully I explained that halfway decent for you. And that's when you follow the timeline, when you take the timeline and put it over the different dates, these dates just fly out at you. And oh, by the way, where this all occurred was, of course, the Department of Justice National Security Division. This is where all of the Department of Justice and FBI, the National Security Department or divisions, this is where all of this activity took place, more or less. And I'm making wide generalizations for the purpose of getting everything in this hour. So why did I bring that up? Well, because you heard of Sally Yates, you know, the oh-so-wonderful woman touted by Strzok and Page in their texts, saying what a woman of moral integrity that she is. Well, Sally Yates is the individual that prevented Inspector General Overview of the National Security Department at the Department of Justice. So, all of this could happen in secret. Now, when you bypass the Inspector General, you bypass the oversight. Remember I said, as my example, there's someone assigned to me when I query a database or, for example, someone from that database company watches what I do, and if it seems like, or the occasional audit, in fact, the quarterly audit on my activity, it occurs, or an audit based on my activity. But Sally Yates, think of it this way. Somebody at the database company pulling off that person saying, hey, you can't audit Doug. Don't audit him. No, 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 no. Well, that's what Sally Yates did. Sally Yates said no, no to the Inspector General. Because this is the National Security Department, you're not the Inspector General. You don't have access to what they do. And it was the New York Times who disclosed that national security letters were used in surveillance of the Donald Trump campaign. Now, there's a specific reason for their use. Inspector General Horowitz was appointed by Obama in 2011, and many people will say, well, Horowitz, Obama appointee, don't hold your breath for whatever he's going to come up with. But he was muzzled from the beginning, because from the very start, he found that his duties were throttled by Eric Holder's Department of Justice. Eric Holder, remember him, okay, from congressional testimony by Michael Horowitz. He stated that they got access to information up to 2010 in all of the categories. No law changed in 2010, no policy changed. It simply was a decision by the general counsel's office in 2010 that they viewed now the law differently, and as a result, they weren't going to give us that information, meaning to say Sally Yates and others. There were new restrictions were put in place by Eric Holder as Attorney General and the former Deputy Attorney General James Cole, who said, we're not going to allow, for example, the IG into our business. Now, Horowitz, to his credit, said, look, we have made requests to audit the activities of the Department of Justice, specifically what they're doing, the aforementioned inquiries and such, but we have been rebuffed. As a matter of fact, Sally Yates came out and said no. Okay. If you go back and look, there was a Michael Horowitz wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post. It was published on October 18th, 2015. He's saying in that op-ed that there was bad stuff happening, if you read between the lines, bad stuff happening within the Department of Justice. It was a rather impassioned editorial. Again, October 18th, 2015. Horowitz wasn't getting anywhere because he was being rebuffed by Eric Holder and the Obama people, so he went to the Washington Post and wrote an op-ed, very impassioned op-ed, to warn the people. But at that time, it wasn't looked at as anything. There was no context for his warning at that time. But when you trace this, you trace everything back. It goes back to Sally Quinlan Yates, Deputy Attorney General, who issued this letter or this disallowance for the Inspector General. It denied the Inspector General access to information under Title III. In other words, July 20, 2015, an opinion titled Memorandum for Sally Yates. It was written by Carl Thompson, the Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General of the Office of Legal Counsel, essentially saying that, here, Sally, here's a legal opinion that allows you to kick out or to not allow the Inspector General access to oversight to audit what's going on. These are Obama people. So when you go to criticize Horowitz, you can look back and you can see him saying, wait a minute, I'm being disallowed the audit capabilities. I'm being told I can't do my job. And he was yelling at this since he became inspector general, since he was nominated inspector general. He was complaining about this. Now, finally, what are we waiting on now? The inspector general's report. Finally, with the election of Donald Trump, Horowitz was allowed to do his job. The impediments to the oversight have been lifted, and now we're waiting for the report from Michael Horowitz. He knew what was going on back then. I mentioned Mike Rogers, okay, back in 2016. That was just that was a point in time that I opted for in terms of the database access. But he knew what was going on before and after that. And, oh, by the way, what Admiral Mike Rogers did, the NSA, head of the NSA, and I've talked about this before, the day after, shortly after Donald Trump was elected president and his transition team was operating at Trump Tower, Mike Rogers, head of the NSA, visited Donald Trump at Trump Tower, didn't tell anyone. And the next day, Donald Trump moved his operation, his entire transition team from Trump Tower to Bedminster, this golf resort in Bedminster. Why? Because Mike Rogers warned him about the both electronic, and this is critical now, think about this, human surveillance. Remember, electronic surveillance can be done anywhere, but why the move? Why the move from Trump Tower to Bedminster? Was there a skiff at Bedminster? Did he just like the digs better? No. There was also a level of protection that the Bedminster Golf Club offered President, then President-elect Donald Trump. And that was protection against human surveillance. Now, I've got some information I have not spoken about publicly ever. But I'm tossing that out there for the individuals at Reddit and other locations. Did you hear what I said? Human surveillance. And I know some of you are already on that level, that plane, thinking the same way or know what I'm talking about. But I'll just say this. Talk amongst yourselves about this. Infiltration into the Donald Trump transition team. Human surveillance. Human contact. Because again, why move from point A to point B if your cell phone is under surveillance or hacked or whatever. It's going to be hacked at point B just as it would be at point A. So moving, changing venues is not going to help you. What's the difference? Why? Think. This is the information that I've not said before. Okay. Now, I want to make mention, I think we're witnessing history. Today, FBI Director of Counterintelligence, Bill Priestap, FBI head, well, he's going to be testifying today behind closed doors to a joint congressional committee of the Judiciary and House Oversight members. Priestap begins his testimony today, I believe. Let me look here to make sure. Yeah, Priestap is going to go first. This is going to be Bill Priestap's first congressional testimony. Again, it's going to be held behind closed doors. And if you want to know who Bill Priestap is, FBI Assistant Director of Counterintelligence, he's central to all of the activity that was happening in both the Clinton investigation and the investigation, in air quotes, of President-elect and candidate and now President Donald Trump. He was the FBI agent. Well, he was Peter Strzok's immediate boss. However, and as is noted in the Strzok page text, Strzok often went around Priestap. directly to McCabe. But starting today, Bill Priestup is going to be testifying behind closed doors. Next up is going to be who? Let me think. Let me see. Oh, yes. We've got Michael Steinbach, who is the FBI head of national security. And we've got John Giacalone, who was the former head of the FBI National Security Division, I believe. So you've got three FBI officials who will be testifying to a joint congressional committee of the Judiciary and House Oversight members beginning today, this week. Now, this joint committee, as noted by the conservative treehouse, Sundance, of course, was formed by Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte and Oversight Chairman Trey Gowdy. So that's taking place, historic information or historic times in which we live. And as noted at the Conservative Treehouse and by Sundance, and I would point this out, I'd be remiss not to, the timing of the testimony speaks to the timing of the upcoming IG's report regarding the politicization of the Department of Justice and FBI surrounding the Clinton investigative outcomes. In other words, what did they do? Remember, well, everyone remembers. Some of the most significant releases have come while President Trump is outside of D.C. and with the G7 on June 8th and 9th in Canada. Hey, you know what? It's very possible and even likely that we might see the IG report within the next couple of days. Just saying. Okay. That's the information out there right now. So I hope that made sense to you, what I explained. When you understand the players, understand what's happening, when you understand the access to information and how this was all massaged, you take a big, wide view of things. It helps the mechanism of understanding. And again, I use remembering when I attended the Forensic Institute and went through that class to look at the crime scene. If you don't get, let's say, all 50 points of, you know, data points, if you don't get all 50 of them, you can't get the full picture of what's happening. So that's why I went over this. This is one aspect of the database access was one aspect of things I wanted to pound home. However, we're looking at the entire infrastructure, the spying mechanism that existed and still exists today to some extent against our president. Remember, the coup is still taking place. The bad guys are still in power. And you might ask, well, why doesn't Donald Trump just fire certain people? Yeah, I asked that same question. Or why doesn't Jeff Sessions unrecuse himself? I don't know the answer to those questions. And I know some people say, well, just trust Sessions. I do know that, for example, John Huber and the Inspector General Mike Horowitz working behind the scenes, I think this will bring a lot of fruit. I would caution, however, everyone not to jump too much on the IG's report. Yes, I believe in it, but let's just wait to see what it provides, because you're going to see in the media especially, you're going to see where the media is going to say, well, this whole thing is a political smokescreen to prevent investigation of Donald Trump. In other words, it's going to direct people's attention where it shouldn't be. This is going to be coming from the media. It's going to be indicting, and how dare we indict the FBI? How dare we indict the activities of the Department of Justice? To those people, I would say just pick up Sidney Powell's book, License to Lie, and you would see how we dare. But the bottom line is this. A lot of things happening. I gave you kind of an overview of the spying infrastructure and how, for example, in this case, the databases and Mike Rogers played a role into what's taking place today. The Inspector General's report perhaps coming out in the next few days. You've got the hearings going on. You can see that we're still in the fight for our lives of this nation. I hope this made sense to you. I really do. Thanks, Captain Roy D. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for being part of this program, the Doug Hagmann Radio Show. Hey, make a thing out of it. Hashtag DHRS on Twitter if you can. I don't know. Can you do that? Feedback in the box below. Thanks for listening. May God bless each and every one of you.
The Doug Hagman Radio Show is brought to you by The Hagman Report. Tune in to The Hagman Report weekdays, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. For more information, go to HagmanReport.com. That's HagmanReport.com.